At length Dron, the village elder, entered the room, and with a deep bow to Princess Mary came to a halt by the doorpost. Princess Mary walked up and down the room and stopped in front of him. "Dronyushka," she said, regarding as a sure friend this Dronyushka who always used to bring a special kind of gingerbread from his visit to the fair at Vyazma every year and smilingly offer it to her. "Dronyushka, now since our misfortune," she began, but could not go on. "We are all in God's hands," said he with a sigh. They were silent for a while. "Dronyushka, Alpátych has gone off somewhere, and I have no one to turn to. Is it true, as they tell me, that I can't even go away?"
"Why shouldn't you go away, Your Excellency? You can go," said Dron.
"I was told it would be dangerous because of the enemy. Dear friend, I can do nothing. I understand nothing. I have nobody. I want to go away tonight or early tomorrow morning."
Dron paused. He looked askance at Princess Mary and said, "There are no horses. I told Yakov Alpátych so."
"Why are there none?" asked the princess.
"It's all God's scourge," said Dron. "What horses we had have been taken for the army or have died. This is such a year. It's not a case of feeding horses. We may die of hunger ourselves. As it is, some go 3 days without eating. We've nothing. We've been ruined."
Princess Mary listened attentively to what he told her. "The peasants are ruined? They have no bread?" she asked.
"They're dying of hunger," said Dron. "It's not a case of carting."
"But why didn't you tell me, Dronyushka? Isn't it possible to help them? I'll do all I can." To Princess Mary, it was strange that now, at a moment when such sorrow was filling her soul, there could be rich people and poor, and the rich could refrain from helping the poor. She had heard vaguely that there was such a thing as landlord's corn, which was sometimes given to the peasants. She also knew that neither her father nor her brother would refuse to help the peasants in need. She only feared to make some mistake in speaking about the distribution of the grain she wished to give. She was glad such cares presented themselves, enabling her without scruple to forget her own grief. Princess Mary began asking Dron about the peasants' needs and what there was in Boguchárovo that belonged to the landlord. "But we have grain belonging to my brother," she said.
"The landlord's grain is all safe," replied Dron proudly. "Our prince did not order it to be sold."
"Give it to the peasants. Let them have all they need. I give you leave in my brother's name," said she. Dron made no answer, but sighed deeply. "Give them that corn if there is enough of it. Distribute it all. I give this order in my brother's name, and tell them that what is ours is theirs. We do not grudge them anything. Tell them so."
Dron looked intently at the princess while she was speaking.
"Discharge me, little mother, for God's sake. Order the keys to be taken from me," said he. "I have served 23 years and have done no wrong. Discharge me, for God's sake."
Princess Mary did not understand what he wanted of her, or why he was asking to be discharged. She replied that she had never doubted his devotion, and that she was ready to do anything for him and for the peasants.
Chapter 11. Princess Mary addresses the peasants. They distrust her and refuse to leave Boguchárovo. An hour later, Dunyasha came to tell the princess that Dron had come, and all the peasants had assembled at the barn by the princess's order and wished to have word with their mistress.
"But I never told them to come," said Princess Mary. "I only told Dron to let them have the grain."
"Only for God's sake, princess dear, have them sent away and don't go out to them. It's all a trick," said Dunyasha. "And when Yakov Alpátych returns, let us get away. And please don't—"
"What is a trick?" asked Princess Mary in surprise.
"I know it is. Only listen to me, for God's sake. Ask nurse, too. They say they don't agree to leave Boguchárovo as you ordered."
"Oh, you are making some mistake. I never ordered them to go away," said Princess Mary. "Call Dronyushka."
Dron came and confirmed Dunyasha's words. The peasants had come by the princess's order.
"But I never sent for them," declared the princess. "You must have given my message wrong. I only said that you were to give them the grain."
Dron only sighed in reply.
"If you order it, they will go away," said he.
"No, no, I'll go out to them," said Princess Mary. And in spite of the nurse's and Dunyasha's protests, she went out into the porch, Dron, Dunyasha, the nurse, and Michael Ivanovich following her. "They probably think I'm offering them the grain to bribe them to remain here while I myself go away, leaving them to the mercy of the French," thought Princess Mary. "I will offer them monthly rations and housing at our Moscow estate. I'm sure Andrew would do even more in my place," she thought, as she went out into the twilight toward the crowd standing on the pasture by the barn. The men crowded closer together, stirred, and rapidly took off their hats. Princess Mary lowered her eyes and, tripping over her skirt, came close up to them. So many different eyes, old and young, were fixed on her, and there were so many different faces that she could not distinguish any of them, and feeling that she must speak to them all at once, did not know how to do it. But again, the sense that she represented her father and her brother gave her courage, and she boldly began her speech. "I'm very glad you've come," she said, without raising her eyes, and feeling her heart beating quickly and violently. "Dronushka tells me that the war has ruined you. That is our common misfortune, and I shall grudge nothing to help you. I am myself going away because it is dangerous here. The enemy is near, because I'm giving you everything, my friends, and I beg you to take everything, all our grain, so that you may not suffer want. And if you have been told that I'm giving you the grain to keep you here, that is not true. On the contrary, I ask you to go with all your belongings to our estate near Moscow, and I promise you I will see to it that there you shall want for nothing. You shall be given food and lodging." The princess stopped. Sighs were the only sound heard in the crowd. "I'm not doing this on my own account," she continued. "I do it in the name of my dead father, who was a good master to you, and of my brother and his son." Again she paused. No one broke the silence. "Ours is a common misfortune, and we will share it together. All that is mine is yours," she concluded, scanning the faces before her. All eyes were gazing at her with one and the same expression. She could not fathom whether it was curiosity, devotion, gratitude, or apprehension and distrust, but the expression on all the faces was identical.
"We're all very thankful for your bounty, but it won't do for us to take the landlord's grain," said a voice at the back of the crowd.
"But why not?" asked the princess. No one replied, and Princess Mary, looking round at the crowd, found that every eye she met now was immediately dropped. "But why don't you want to take it?" she asked again. No one answered. The silence began to oppress the princess, and she tried to catch someone's eye. "Why don't you speak?" she inquired of a very old man who stood just in front of her, leaning on his stick. "If you think something more is wanted, tell me. I will do anything," said she, catching his eye. But as if this angered him, he bent his head quite low and muttered,
"Why should we agree? We don't want the grain. Why should we give up everything? No, we don't agree. We don't agree. We're sorry for you, but we're not willing. Go away yourself, alone,"
came from various sides of the crowd. And again all the faces in that crowd bore an identical expression, though now it was certainly not an expression of curiosity or gratitude, but of angry resolve.
"But you can't have understood me," said Princess Mary with a sad smile. "Why don't you want to go? I promised to house and feed you, while here the enemy would ruin you."
But her voice was drowned by the voices of the crowd.
"Oh, we're not willing. Well, let them ruin us. We won't take your grain. We don't agree."
Again Princess Mary tried to catch someone's eye, but not a single eye in the crowd was turned to her. Evidently they were all trying to avoid her look. She felt strange and awkward.
"Oh, yes. An artful tale. Follow her into slavery. Pull down your houses and go into bondage, I dare say.
I'll give you grain indeed," she says,
voices in the crowd were heard saying. With drooping head, Princess Mary left the crowd and went back to the house. Having repeated her order to Dron to have horses ready for her departure next morning, she went to her room
and remained alone with her own thoughts. Chapter 12. Princess Mary at night recalls her last sight of her father. For a long time that night, Princess Mary sat by the open window of her room, hearing the sound of the peasants' voices that reached her from the village. But it was not of them she was thinking. She felt that she could not understand them, however much she might think about them. She thought only of one thing, her sorrow, which, after the break caused by cares for the present, seemed already to belong to the past. Now she could remember it and weep or pray. After sunset, the wind had dropped. The night was calm and fresh. Toward midnight, the voices began to subside. A cock crowed. The full moon began to show from behind the lime trees. A fresh, white, dewy mist began to rise, and stillness reigned over the village and the house. Pictures of the near past, her father's illness and last moments, rose one after another to her memory. With mournful pleasure, she now lingered over these images, repelling with horror only the last one, the picture of his death, which she felt she could not contemplate even in imagination at this still and mystic hour of night. And these pictures presented themselves to her so clearly and in such detail that they seemed now present, now past, and now future. She vividly recalled the moment when he had had his first stroke and was being dragged along by his armpits through the garden at Bald Hills, muttering something with his helpless tongue, twitching his grey eyebrows, and looking uneasily and timidly at her. "Even then he wanted to tell me what he told me the day he died," she thought. He had always thought what he said then. And she recalled in all its detail the night at Bald Hills before he had the last stroke, when with a foreboding of disaster she had remained at home against his will. She had not slept, and had stolen downstairs on tiptoe, and going to the door of the conservatory where he slept that night had listened at the door. In a suffering and weary voice he was saying something to Tichon, speaking of the Crimea and its warm nights, and of the Empress. Evidently he had wanted to talk. And why didn't he call me? Why didn't he let me be there instead of Tichon? Princess Mary had thought and thought again now. Now he will never tell anyone what he had in his soul. Never will that moment return for him or for me, when he might have said all he longed to say, and not Tichon, but I might have heard and understood him. Why didn't I enter the room? She thought. Perhaps he would then have said to me what he said the day he died. While talking to Tichon, he asked about me twice. He wanted to see me, and I was standing close by outside the door. It was sad and painful for him to talk to Tichon, who did not understand him. I remember how he began speaking to him about Lise, as if she were alive. He had forgotten she was dead. And Tichon reminded him that she was no more, and he shouted, "Fool!" He was greatly depressed. From behind the door I heard how he lay down on his bed groaning and loudly exclaimed, "My God! Why didn't I go in then? What could he have done to me? What could I have lost?" And perhaps he would then have been comforted and would have said that word to me. And Princess Mary uttered aloud the caressing word he had said to her on the day of his death. "Dearest," she repeated, and began sobbing with tears that relieved her soul. She now saw his face before her, and not the face she had known ever since she could remember and had always seen at a distance, but the timid, feeble face she had seen for the first time quite closely, with all its wrinkles and details, when she stooped near to his mouth to catch what he said. "Dearest," she repeated again. What was he thinking when he uttered that word? What is he thinking now? This question suddenly presented itself to her, and in the answer She saw him before her with the expression that was on his face as he lay in his coffin, with his chin bound up with a white handkerchief. And the horror that had seized her when she touched him and convinced herself that that was not he, but something mysterious and horrible, seized her again. She tried to think of something else and to pray, but could do neither. With wide open eyes, she gazed at the moonlight and the shadows, expecting every moment to see his dead face, and she felt that the silence brooding over the house and within it held her fast. "Dunyasha," she whispered.
"Dunyasha!"
she screamed wildly, and tearing herself out of the silence, she ran to the servants' quarters to meet her old nurse and the maidservants who came running toward her. Chapter 13. Nicholas and Ilyin ride to Boguchárovo. They are asked by Alpátych to protect the princess. Nicholas makes her acquaintance and places himself at her service. On the 17th of August, Rostov and Ilyin, accompanied by Lavrushka, who had just returned from captivity, and by an hussar orderly, left their quarters at Yankovo, 10 miles from Boguchárovo, and went for a ride, to try a new horse Ilyin had bought, and to find out whether there was any hay to be had in the villages. For the last 3 days, Boguchárovo had lain between the two hostile armies, so that it was as easy for the Russian rear guard to get to it as for the French vanguard. Rostov, as a careful squadron commander, wished to take such provisions as remained at Boguchárovo before the French could get them. Rostov and Ilyin were in the merriest of moods. On the way to Boguchárovo, a princely estate with a dwelling house and farm where they hoped to find many domestic serfs and pretty girls, they questioned Lavrushka about Napoleon and laughed at his stories and raced one another to try Ilyin's horse. Rostov had no idea that the village he was entering was the property of that very Bolkonski who had been engaged to his sister. Rostov and Ilyin gave rein to their horses for a last race along the incline before reaching Boguchárovo, and Rostov, outstripping Ilyin, was the first to gallop into the village street.
"You're first," cried Ilyin, flushed.
"Yes, always first, both on the grassland and here," answered Rostov, stroking his heated Donets horse.
"And I'd have won on my Frenchie, Your Excellency," said Lavrushka from behind, alluding to a shabby cart horse. "Only I didn't wish to mortify you."
They rode at a footpace to the barn, where a large crowd of peasants was standing. Some of them bared their heads. Others stared at the new arrivals without doffing their caps. Two tall old peasants with wrinkled faces and scanty beards emerged from the tavern, smiling, staggering, and singing some incoherent song, and approached the officers.
"Fine fellows," said Rostov, laughing. "Is there any hay here?"
"And how like one another," said Ilyin.
"A most merry company,"
sang one of the peasants with a blissful smile. One of the men came out of the crowd and went up to Rostov.
"Who do you belong to?" he asked.
"The French," replied Ilyin jestingly. "And here is Napoleon himself," and he pointed to Lavrushka.
"Then you are Russians?" the peasant asked again. "And is there a large force of you here?" said another, a short man, coming up.
"Very large," answered Rostov. "But why have you collected here?" he added. "Is it a holiday?"
"The old men have met to talk over the business of the commune," replied the peasant, moving away.
At that moment, on the road leading from the big house, two women and a man in a white hat were seen coming toward the officers. "The one in pink is mine, so keep off," said Ilyin on seeing Dunyasha running resolutely toward him.
"She'll be ours," said Lavrushka to Ilyin, winking.
"What do you want, my pretty?" said Ilyin with a smile. "The princess ordered me to ask your regiment and your name."
"This is Count Rostov, squadron commander, and I am your humble servant."
"A company,"
roared the tipsy peasant with a beatific smile as he looked at Ilyin talking to the girl. Following Dunyasha, Alpátych advanced to Rostov, having bared his head while still at a distance.
"May I make bold to trouble your honor?" said he respectfully, but with a shade of contempt for the youthfulness of this officer, and with a hand thrust into his bosom. "My mistress, daughter of General-in-Chief Prince Nicholas Bolkonski, who died on the 15th of this month,
finding herself in difficulties owing to the boorishness of these people," he pointed to the peasants, "asks you to come up to the house. Won't you please ride on a little farther?" said Alpátych with a melancholy smile. "As it is not convenient in the presence of..." He pointed to the two peasants who kept as close to him as horse flies to a horse.
"Ah, Alpátych! Yakov Alpátych! Grant, forgive us, for Christ's sake, eh?"
said the peasants, smiling joyfully at him. Rostov looked at the tipsy peasants and smiled.
"Or perhaps they amuse your honor?" remarked Alpátych with a staid air, as he pointed at the old man with his free hand.
"No, there's not much to be amused at here," said Rostov, and rode on a little way. "What's the matter?" he asked.
"I make bold to inform your honor that the rude peasants here don't wish to let the mistress leave the estate, and threaten to unharness her horses, so that, though everything has been packed up since morning, Her Excellency cannot get away."
"Impossible!" exclaimed Rostov.
"I have the honor to report to you the actual truth," said Alpátych.
Rostov dismounted, gave his horse to the orderly, and followed Alpátych to the house, questioning him as to the state of affairs. It appeared that the princess's offer of corn to the peasants the previous day, and her talk with Dron and at the meeting, had actually had so bad an effect that Dron had finally given up the keys and joined the peasants, and had not appeared when Alpátych sent for him, and that in the morning, when the princess gave orders to harness for her journey, the peasants had come in a large crowd to the barn and sent word that they would not let her leave the village, that there was an order not to move, and that they would unharness the horses. Alpátych had gone out to admonish them, but was told — it was chiefly Karp who did the talking, Dron not showing himself in the crowd — that they could not let the princess go, that there was an order to the contrary, but that if she stayed, they would serve her as before and obey her in everything. At the moment when Rostov and Ilyin were galloping along the road, Princess Mary, despite the dissuasions of Alpátych, her nurse, and the maids, had given orders to harness and intended to start. But when the cavalrymen were espied, they were taken for Frenchmen. The coachman ran away, and the women in the house began to wail.
"Father, benefactor, God has sent you!" exclaimed deeply moved voices as Rostov passed through the anteroom.
Princess Mary was sitting helpless and bewildered in the large sitting room when Rostov was shown in. She could not grasp who he was and why he had come or what was happening to her. When she saw his Russian face, and by his walk and the first words he uttered, recognized him as a man of her own class, she glanced at him with her deep, radiant look and began speaking in a voice that faltered and trembled with emotion. This meeting immediately struck Rostov as a romantic event. A helpless girl, overwhelmed with grief, left to the mercy of coarse, rioting peasants. And what a strange fate sent me here. What gentleness and nobility there are in her features and expression, thought he, as he looked at her and listened to her timid story. When she began to tell him that all this had happened the day after her father's funeral, her voice trembled. She turned away, and then, as if fearing he might take her words as meant to move him to pity, looked at him with an apprehensive glance of inquiry. There were tears in Rostov's eyes. Princess Mary noticed this and glanced gratefully at him with that radiant look which caused the plainness of her face to be forgotten. "I cannot express, Princess, how glad I am that I happened to ride here and am able to show my readiness to serve you," said Rostov, rising. "Go when you please, and I give you my word of honor that no one shall dare to cause you annoyance, if only you will allow me to act as your escort." And bowing respectfully, as if to a lady of royal blood, he moved toward the door. Rostov's deferential tone seemed to indicate that though he would consider himself happy to be acquainted with her, he did not wish to take advantage of her misfortunes to intrude upon her. Princess Mary understood this and appreciated his delicacy. "I am very, very grateful to you," she said in French, "but I hope it was all a misunderstanding and that no one is to blame for it." She suddenly began to cry.
"Excuse me," she said.
Rostov, knitting his brows, left the room with another low bow. Chapter 14. Nicholas calls the peasants to account and intimidates them.
Carts and horses are provided for Princess Mary's departure. Princess Mary feels that she loves him.
Well, is she pretty?
Ah, friend, my pink one is delicious. Her name is Dunyasha. But on glancing at Rostov's face, Ilyin stopped short. He saw that his hero and commander was following quite a different train of thought. Rostov glanced angrily at Ilyin, and without replying, strode off with rapid steps to the village.
I'll show them. I'll give it to them, the brigands, said he to himself.
Alpatych, at a gliding trot, only just managing not to run, kept up with him with difficulty.
What decision have you been pleased to come to? Said he.
Rostov stopped, and clenching his fists, suddenly and sternly turned on Alpatych.
Decision? What decision? Old dotard! Cried he. What have you been about, eh? The peasants are rioting and you can't manage them. You're a traitor yourself. I know you. I'll flay you all alive.
And as if afraid of wasting his store of anger, he left Alpatych and went rapidly forward. Alpatych, mastering his offended feelings, kept pace with Rostov at a gliding gait and continued to impart his views. He said the peasants were obdurate and that at the present moment it would be imprudent to over-resist them without an armed force. And would it not be better first to send for the military?
I'll give them armed force. I'll over-resist them, uttered Rostov meaninglessly, breathless with irrational animal fury and the need to vent it.
Without considering what he would do, he moved unconsciously with quick, resolute steps toward the crowd. And the nearer he drew to it, the more Alpatych felt that this unreasonable action might produce good results. The peasants in the crowd were similarly impressed when they saw Rostov's rapid, firm steps and resolute, frowning face. After the hussars had come to the village, and Rostov had gone to see the princess, a certain confusion and dissension had arisen among the crowd. Some of the peasants said that these new arrivals were Russians and might take it amiss that the mistress was being detained. Dron was of this opinion, but as soon as he expressed it, Karp and others attacked their ex-elder.
How many years have you been fattening on the commune? Karp shouted at him. It's all one to you. You'll dig up your pot of money and take it away with you. What does it matter to you whether our homes are ruined or not? We've been told to keep order and that no one is to leave their homes or take away a single grain, and that's all about it, cried another. It was your son's turn to be conscripted, but no fear. You begrudged your lump of a son.
A little old man suddenly began attacking Dron.
And so they took my Vanka to be shaved for a soldier. But we all have to die. To be sure, we all have to die. I'm not against the commune, said Dron. That's it, not against it. You filled your belly.
The two tall peasants had their say. As soon as Rostov, followed by Ilyin, Lavrushka, and Alpatych, came up to the crowd, Karp, thrusting his fingers into his belt and smiling a little, walked to the front. Dron, on the contrary, retired to the rear, and the crowd drew closer together.
"Who is your elder here, eh?"
shouted Rostov, coming up to the crowd with quick steps.
"The elder? What do you want with him?" asked Karp.
But before the words were well out of his mouth, his cap flew off, and a fierce blow jerked his head to one side.
"Caps off, traitors!" shouted Rostov in a wrathful voice. "Where's the elder?"
he cried furiously.
"The elder. He wants the elder. Dron Zakharych, you!"
Meek and flustered voices here and there were heard calling, and caps began to come off their heads.
"We don't riot. We're following the orders," declared Karp.
And at that moment several voices began speaking together.
"It's as the old men have decided. There's too many of you giving orders." "Arguing? Mutiny! Brigands! Traitors!"
cried Rostov unmeaningly, in a voice not his own, gripping Karp by the collar.
"Bind him! Bind him!" he shouted,
though there was no one to bind him but Lavrushka and Alpatych. Lavrushka, however, ran up to Karp and seized him by the arms from behind.
"Shall I call up our men from beyond the hill?" he called out.
Alpatych turned to the peasants and ordered two of them by name to come and bind Karp. The men obediently came out of the crowd and began taking off their belts.
"Where's the elder?"
demanded Rostov in a loud voice. With a pale and frowning face, Dron stepped out of the crowd.
"Are you the elder?
Bind him, Lavrushka,"
shouted Rostov, as if that order too could not possibly meet with any opposition.
and in fact two more peasants began binding Dron, who took off his own belt and handed it to them as if to aid them. "And you all listen to me," said Rostov to the peasants. "Be off to your houses at once, and don't let one of your voices be heard."
"Why, we've not done any harm. We did it just out of foolishness. It's all nonsense."
"I said then that it was not an order." Voices were heard bickering with one another. "There, what did I say?" said Alpátych, coming into his own again. "It's wrong, lads."
"All our stupidity, Yakov Alpátych," came the answers,
and the crowd began at once to disperse through the village. The two bound men were led off to the master's house. The two drunken peasants followed them.
"Aye, when I look at you," said one of them to Karp, "how can one talk to their masters like that? What were you thinking of, you fool?"
added the other.
"A real fool."
2 hours later, the carts were standing in the courtyard of the Bogucharovo house. The peasants were briskly carrying out the proprietor's goods and packing them on the carts, and Dron, liberated at Princess Mary's wish from the cupboard where he had been confined, was standing in the yard directing the men.
"Don't put it in so carelessly,"
said one of the peasants, a man with a round, smiling face, taking a casket from a housemaid.
"You know it has cost money. How can you chuck it in like that or shove it under the cord where it'll get rubbed? I don't like that way of doing things. Let it all be done properly, according to rule. Look here, put it under the bast matting and cover it with hay. That's the way."
"Hey, books, books," said another peasant, bringing out Prince Andrew's library cupboards.
"Don't catch up against it. It's heavy, lads. Solid books."
"Yes. They worked all day and didn't play," remarked the tall, round-faced peasant gravely, pointing with a significant wink at the dictionaries that were on the top.
Unwilling to obtrude himself on the princess, Rostov did not go back to the house, but remained in the village awaiting her departure. When her carriage drove out of the house, he mounted and accompanied her 8 miles from Bogucharovo to where the road was occupied by our troops. At the inn at Yankovo, he respectfully took leave of her, for the first time permitting himself to kiss her hand. "How can you speak so?" he blushingly replied to Princess Mary's expressions of gratitude for her deliverance, as she termed what had occurred. "Any police officer would have done as much. If we had had only peasants to fight, we should not have let the enemy come so far," said he with a sense of shame and wishing to change the subject. "I'm only happy to have had the opportunity of making your acquaintance. Goodbye, Princess. I wish you happiness and consolation, and hope to meet you again in happier circumstances. If you don't want to make me blush, please don't thank me." But the princess, if she did not again thank him in words, thanked him with the whole expression of her face, radiant with gratitude and tenderness. She could not believe that there was nothing to thank him for. On the contrary, it seemed to her certain that had he not been there, she would have perished at the hands of the mutineers and of the French, and that he had exposed himself to terrible and obvious danger to save her. And even more certain was it that he was a man of lofty and noble soul, able to understand her position and her sorrow. His kind, honest eyes, with the tears rising in them when she herself had begun to cry as she spoke of her loss, did not leave her memory. When she had taken leave of him and remained alone, she suddenly felt her eyes filling with tears. And then, not for the first time, the strange question presented itself to her. Did she love him? On the rest of the way to Moscow, though the princess's position was not a cheerful one, Dunyasha, who went with her in the carriage, more than once noticed that her mistress leaned out of the window and smiled at something with an expression of mingled joy and sorrow. "Well, supposing I do love him," thought Princess Mary. Ashamed as she was of acknowledging to herself that she had fallen in love with a man who would perhaps never love her, she comforted herself with the thought that no one would ever know it, and that she would not be to blame if, without ever speaking of it to anyone, she continued to the end of her life to love the man with whom she had fallen in love for the first and last time in her life. Sometimes, when she recalled his looks, his sympathy, and his words, happiness did not appear impossible to her.
It was at those moments that Dunyasha noticed her smiling as she looked out of the carriage window. Was it not fate that brought him to Boguchárovo, and at that very moment, thought Princess Mary, and that caused his sister to refuse my brother? And in all this, Princess Mary saw the hand of Providence. Note, a woman might not marry her brother's or sister's brother-in-law, and vice versa, so that if Natasha had married Prince Andrew, it would have been an obstacle to marriage between Mary and Nicholas. The impression the princess made on Rostov was a very agreeable one. To remember her gave him pleasure, and when his comrades, hearing of his adventure at Boguchárovo, rallied him on having gone to look for hay and having picked up one of the wealthiest heiresses in Russia, he grew angry. It made him angry just because the idea of marrying the gentle Princess Mary, who was attractive to him and had an enormous fortune, had, against his will, more than once entered his head. For himself personally, Nicholas could not wish for a better wife. By marrying her, he would make the Countess his mother happy, would be able to put his father's affairs in order, and would even, he felt it, ensure Princess Mary's happiness. But Sonya? And his plighted word? That was why Rostov grew angry when he was rallied about Princess Bolkonskaya. Chapter 15. Prince Andrew goes to headquarters and meets Denisov, who wants guerrilla troops to break the French line of communication. Kutuzov's reception of them. He transacts business. On receiving command of the armies, Kutuzov remembered Prince Andrew and sent an order for him to report at headquarters. Prince Andrew arrived at Tsarevo Zaymishche on the very day and at the very hour that Kutuzov was reviewing the troops for the first time. He stopped in the village at the priest's house, in front of which stood the commander-in-chief's carriage, and he sat down on the bench at the gate awaiting His Serene Highness, as everyone now called Kutuzov. From the field beyond the village came now sounds of regimental music and now the roar of many voices shouting hurrah to the new commander-in-chief. Two orderlies, a courier and a major-domo, stood nearby, some 10 paces from Prince Andrew, availing themselves of Kutuzov's absence and of the fine weather. A short, swarthy lieutenant-colonel of hussars, with thick moustaches and whiskers, rode up to the gate, and, glancing at Prince Andrew, inquired whether His Serene Highness was putting up there, and whether he would soon be back. Prince Andrew replied that he was not on His Serene Highness's staff, but was himself a new arrival. The lieutenant-colonel turned to a smart orderly, who, with the peculiar contempt with which a commander-in-chief's orderly speaks to officers, replied, "What? His Serene Highness? I expect you'll be here soon. What do you want?" The lieutenant-colonel of hussars smiled beneath his moustache at the orderly's tone, dismounted, gave his horse to a dispatch runner, and approached Bolkonski with a slight bow. Bolkonski made room for him on the bench, and the lieutenant-colonel sat down beside him. "You're also waiting for the commander-in-chief," said he. "They say he receives everyone, thank God. It's awful with those sausage-eaters. Yermolov had reason to ask to be promoted to be a German. Now perhaps Russians will get a look in. As it was, devil only knows what was happening. We kept retreating and retreating. Did you take part in the campaign?" he asked.
"I had the pleasure," replied Prince Andrew, "not only of taking part in the retreat, but of losing in that retreat all I held dear, not to mention the estate and home of my birth, my father, who died of grief. I belong to the province of Smolensk."
"Ah, you're Prince Bolkonski? Very glad to make your acquaintance. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Denisov, better known as Vaska," said Denisov, pressing Prince Andrew's hand and looking into his face with a particularly kindly attention. "Yes, I heard," said he sympathetically, and after a short pause added, "Yes, it's Scythian warfare. It's all very well, only not for those who get it in the neck. So you are Prince Andrew Bolkonski?" He swayed his head. "Very pleased, Prince, to make your acquaintance,"
he repeated again, smiling sadly, and he again pressed Prince Andrew's hand. Prince Andrew knew Denisov from what Natasha had told him of her first suitor. This memory carried him sadly and sweetly back to those painful feelings of which he had not thought lately, but which still found place in his soul.
Of late he had received so many new and very serious impressions, such as the retreat from Smolensk, his visit to Bald Hills, and the recent news of his father's death, and had experienced so many emotions, that for a long time past those memories had not entered his mind, and now that they did not act on him with nearly their former strength. For Denisov, too, the memories awakened by the name of Bolkonski belonged to a distant romantic past, when after supper and after Natasha's singing he had proposed to a little girl of 15 without realizing what he was doing. He smiled at the recollection of that time and of his love for Natasha, and passed at once to what now interested him passionately and exclusively. This was a plan of campaign he had devised while serving at the outposts during the retreat. He had proposed that plan to Barclay de Tolly, and now wished to propose it to Kutuzov. The plan was based on the fact that the French line of operation was too extended, and it proposed that instead of, or concurrently with, action on the front to bar the advance of the French, we should attack their line of communication. He began explaining his plan to Prince Andrew.
They can't hold all that line. It's impossible. I will undertake to break through. Give me 500 men, and I will break the line, that's certain. There's only one way. Guerrilla warfare.
Denisov rose and began gesticulating as he explained his plan to Bolkonski. In the midst of his explanation, shouts were heard from the army, growing more incoherent and more diffused, mingling with music and songs, and coming from the field where the review was held. Sounds of hoofs and shouts were nearing the village.
"He's coming! He's coming!"
shouted a Cossack standing at the gate. Bolkonski and Denisov moved to the gate, at which a knot of soldiers, a guard of honor, was standing, and they saw Kutuzov coming down the street mounted on a rather small sorrel horse. A huge suite of generals rode behind him. Barclay was riding almost beside him, and a crowd of officers ran after and around them shouting hurrah. His adjutants galloped into the yard before him. Kutuzov was impatiently urging on his horse, which ambled smoothly under his weight, and he raised his hand to his white horse guard's cap with a red band and no peak, nodding his head continually. When he came up to the guard of honor, a fine set of grenadiers mostly wearing decorations who were giving him the salute, he looked at them silently and attentively for nearly a minute with the steady gaze of a commander, and then turned to the crowd of generals and officers surrounding him. Suddenly his face assumed a subtle expression. He shrugged his shoulders with an air of perplexity.
"And with such fine fellows to retreat and retreat? Well, goodbye, General," he added, and rode into the yard past Prince Andrew and Denisov. "Hurrah! Hurrah! Hurrah!"
shouted those behind him. Since Prince Andrew had last seen him, Kutuzov had grown still more corpulent, flaccid, and fat. But the bleached eyeball, the scar, and the familiar weariness of his expression were still the same. He was wearing the white horse guard's cap and a military overcoat, with a whip hanging over his shoulder by a thin strap. He sat heavily and swayed limply on his brisk little horse. He whistled just audibly as he rode into the yard. His face expressed the relief of relaxed strain felt by a man who means to rest after a ceremony. He drew his left foot out of the stirrup, and, lurching with his whole body and puckering his face with the effort, raised it with difficulty onto the saddle, leaned on his knee, groaned, and slipped down into the arms of the Cossacks and adjutants who stood ready to assist him. He pulled himself together, looked round, screwing up his eyes, glanced at Prince Andrew, and, evidently not recognizing him, moved with his waddling gait to the porch. He whistled, and again glanced at Prince Andrew. As often occurs with old men, it was only after some seconds that the impression produced by Prince Andrew's face linked itself up with Kutuzov's remembrance of his personality.
"Ah, how do you do, my dear prince? How do you do, my dear boy? Come along,"
said he, glancing wearily round, and he stepped onto the porch, which creaked under his weight. He unbuttoned his coat and sat down on a bench in the porch.
"And how's your father?"
"I received news of his death yesterday," replied Prince Andrew abruptly. Kutuzov looked at him with eyes wide open with dismay, and then took off his cap and crossed himself.
May the kingdom of heaven be his. God's will be done to us all.
He sighed deeply, his whole chest heaving, and was silent for a while.
I loved him and respected him, and sympathize with you with all my heart.
He embraced Prince Andrew, pressing him to his fat breast, and for some time did not let him go. When he released him, Prince Andrew saw that Kutuzov's flabby lips were trembling, and the tears were in his eyes. He sighed and pressed on the bench with both hands to raise himself.
"Come, come with me, we'll have a talk," said he.
But at that moment Denisov, no more intimidated by his superiors than by the enemy, came with jingling spurs up the steps of the porch, despite the angry whispers of the adjutants who tried to stop him. Kutuzov, his hands still pressed on the seat, glanced at him glumly. Denisov, having given his name, announced that he had to communicate to His Serene Highness a matter of great importance for their country's welfare. Kutuzov looked wearily at him, and lifting his hands with a gesture of annoyance, folded them across his stomach, repeating the words,
"For our country's welfare?" "Well, what is it? Speak."
Denisov blushed like a girl. It was strange to see the color rise in that shaggy, bibulous, time-worn face, and boldly began to expound his plan of cutting the enemy's lines of communication between Smolensk and Vyazma. Denisov came from those parts and knew the country well. His plan seemed decidedly a good one, especially from the strength of conviction with which he spoke. Kutuzov looked down at his own legs, occasionally glancing at the door of the adjoining hut as if expecting something unpleasant to emerge from it. And from that hut, while Denisov was speaking, a general with a portfolio under his arm really did appear.
"What?" said Kutuzov in the midst of Denisov's explanations. "Are you ready so soon?"
"Ready, Your Serene Highness," replied the general. Kutuzov swayed his head as much as to say, "How is one man to deal with it all?" and again listened to Denisov.
"I give my word of honor as a Russian officer," said Denisov, "that I can break Napoleon's line of communication." "What relation are you to Intendant General Kirill Andreevich Denisov?" asked Kutuzov, interrupting him. "He's my uncle, Your Serene Highness."
"Ah, we were friends," said Kutuzov cheerfully.
All right, friends, stay here at the staff, and tomorrow we'll have a talk."
With a nod to Denisov, he turned away and put out his hand for the papers Konovnitsyn had brought him.
"Would not Your Serene Highness like to come inside?" said the general on duty in a discontented voice. "The plans must be examined, and several papers have to be signed."
An adjutant came out and announced that everything was in readiness within. But Kutuzov evidently did not wish to enter that room till he was disengaged. He made a grimace.
Tell them to bring a small table out here, my dear boy. I look at them here," said he. "Don't go away," he added, turning to Prince Andrew, who remained in the porch and listened to the general's report.
While this was being given, Prince Andrew heard the whisper of a woman's voice and the rustle of a silk dress behind the door. Several times, on glancing that way, he noticed behind that door a plump, rosy, handsome woman in a pink dress with a lilac silk kerchief on her head, holding a dish and evidently awaiting the entrance of the commander-in-chief. Kutuzov's adjutant whispered to Prince Andrew that this was the wife of the priest whose home it was, and that she intended to offer His Serene Highness bread and salt. Note, it is a Russian custom to present bread and salt to anyone who is taking up residence in a new place.
"Her husband has welcomed His Serene Highness with the cross at the church, and she intends to welcome him in the house. She's very pretty," added the adjutant with a smile.
At those words, Kutuzov looked round. He was listening to the general's report, which consisted chiefly of a criticism of the position at Tsarevo Zaymishche, as he had listened to Denisov, and 7 years previously had listened to the discussion at the Austerlitz Council of War. He evidently listened only because he had ears which, though there was a piece of tow in one of them, could not help hearing. But it was evident that nothing the general could say would surprise or even interest him, that he knew all that would be said beforehand, and heard it all only because he had to, as one has to listen to the chanting of a service of prayer. All that Denisov had said was clever and to the point. What the general was saying was even more clever and to the point.
but it was evident that Kutuzov despised knowledge and cleverness and knew of something else that would decide the matter, something independent of cleverness and knowledge. Prince Andrew watched the commander-in-chief's face attentively, and the only expression he could see there was one of boredom, curiosity as to the meaning of the feminine whispering behind the door, and a desire to observe propriety. It was evident that Kutuzov despised cleverness and learning, and even the patriotic feeling shown by Denisov, but despised them not because of his own intellect, feelings, or knowledge. He did not try to display any of these, but because of something else. He despised them because of his old age and experience of life. The only instruction Kutuzov gave of his own accord during that report referred to looting by the Russian troops. At the end of the report, the general put before him for signature a paper relating to the recovery of payment from army commanders for green oats mowed down by the soldiers when landowners lodged petitions for compensation. After hearing the matter, Kutuzov smacked his lips together and shook his head.
"Into the stove, into the fire with it. I tell you once for all, my dear fellow," said he, "into the fire with all such things. Let them cut the crops and burn wood to their heart's content. I don't order it or allow it, but I don't exact compensation either. One can't get on without it. When wood is chopped, the chips will fly."
He looked at the paper again.
"Oh, this German precision," he muttered, shaking his head.
Chapter 16. The Priest's Wife Offers Kutuzov Bread and Salt. He has a further talk with Prince Andrew, who declines a place on the staff. Patience and time. Prince Andrew's confidence in Kutuzov.
"Well, that's all,"
said Kutuzov as he signed the last of the documents, and rising heavily and smoothing out the folds in his fat white neck, he moved toward the door with a more cheerful expression. The priest's wife, flushing rosy red, caught up the dish she had, after all, not managed to present at the right moment, though she had so long been preparing for it, and with a low bow offered it to Kutuzov. He screwed up his eyes, smiled, lifted her chin with his hand, and said,
"Ah, what a beauty. Thank you, sweetheart."
He took some gold pieces from his trouser pocket and put them on the dish for her.
"Well, my dear, and how are we getting on?" he asked, moving to the door of the room assigned to him.
The priest's wife smiled, and with dimples in her rosy cheeks followed him into the room. The adjutant came out to the porch and asked Prince Andrew to lunch with him. Half an hour later, Prince Andrew was again called to Kutuzov. He found him reclining in an armchair, still in the same unbuttoned overcoat. He had in his hand a French book, which he closed as Prince Andrew entered, marking the place with a knife. Prince Andrew saw by the cover that it was Les Chevaliers du Cygne by Madame de Genlis.
"Well, sit down here. Let's have a talk," said Kutuzov. "It's sad, very sad. But remember, my dear fellow, that I'm a father to you, a second father."
Prince Andrew told Kutuzov all he knew of his father's death and what he had seen at Bald Hills when he passed through it.
What they have brought us to,"
Kutuzov suddenly cried in an agitated voice, evidently picturing vividly to himself from Prince Andrew's story the condition Russia was in.
"But give me time, give me time," he said with a grim look, evidently not wishing to continue this agitating conversation, and added, "I sent for you to keep you with me."
"I thank your Serene Highness, but I fear I'm no longer fit for the staff," replied Prince Andrew with a smile which Kutuzov noticed. Kutuzov glanced inquiringly at him. "But above all," added Prince Andrew, "I've grown used to my regiment, am fond of the officers, and I fancy the men also like me. I should be sorry to leave the regiment. If I decline the honor of being with you, believe me..." A shrewd, kindly, yet subtly derisive expression lit up Kutuzov's podgy face. He cut Bolkonski short.
"I'm sorry, for I need you. But you're right, you're right. It's not here that men are needed. Advisors are always plentiful, but men are not. The regiments would not be what they are if the would-be advisors served there as you do. I remember you at Austerlitz. I remember. Yes, I remember you with the standard," said Kutuzov.
and a flush of pleasure suffused Prince Andrew's face at this recollection. Taking Prince Andrew's hand and drawing him downwards, Kutuzov offered his cheek to be kissed, and again Prince Andrew noticed tears in the old man's eyes. Though Prince Andrew knew that Kutuzov's tears came easily, and that he was particularly tender to and considerate of him from a wish to show sympathy with his loss, yet the reminder he had just given him of Austerlitz was both pleasant and flattering to him.
"Go your way, and God be with you. I know your path is the path of honor."
He paused.
"I missed you at Bucharest, but I needed someone to send."
And changing the subject, Kutuzov began to speak of the Turkish war and the peace that had been concluded.
"Yes, I have been much blamed," he said, "both for that war and the peace. But everything came at the right time. Tout vient à point à celui qui sait attendre.
Everything comes in time to him who knows how to wait."
"And there were as many advisers there as here," he went on, returning to the subject of advisers, which evidently occupied him. "Ah, those advisers," said he. "If we'd listened to them all, we should not have made peace with Turkey and should not have been through with that war. Everything in haste, but more haste, less speed. Kamyansky would have been lost if he had not died. He stormed fortresses with 30,000 men. It is not difficult to capture a fortress, but it is difficult to win a campaign. For that, not storming and attacking, but patience and time are wanted. Kamyansky sent soldiers to Rushchuk, but I only employed these two things and took more fortresses than Kamyansky and made the Turks eat horse flesh." He swayed his head. "And the French shall too, believe me," he went on, growing warmer and beating his chest. "I'll make them eat horse flesh." And tears again dimmed his eyes.
"But shan't we have to accept battle?" remarked Prince Andrew.
"We shall, if everybody wants it. It can't be helped. But believe me, my dear boy, there is nothing stronger than those two. Patience and time. They will do it all. But the advisers n'entendent pas de cette oreille, voilà le mal.
Don't see it that way, that's the trouble.
Some want a thing, others don't. What's one to do?"
he asked, evidently expecting an answer.
"Well, what do you want us to do?"
he repeated, and his eyes shone with a deep, shrewd look.
"I'll tell you what to do,"
he continued, as Prince Andrew still did not reply.
"I will tell you what to do, and what I do. Dans le doute, mon cher."
When in doubt, my dear fellow, he paused.
Abstiens-toi.
Do nothing. He articulated the French proverb deliberately.
Well, goodbye, my dear fellow. Remember that with all my heart I share your sorrow, and that for you I'm not a Serene Highness, nor a prince, nor a commander-in-chief, but a father. If you want anything, come straight to me. Goodbye, my dear boy."
Again he embraced and kissed Prince Andrew. But before the latter had left the room, Kutuzov gave a sigh of relief and went on with his unfinished novel, Les Chevaliers du Cygne, by Madame de Genlis. Prince Andrew could not have explained how or why it was, but after that interview with Kutuzov, he went back to his regiment, reassured as to the general course of affairs and as to the man to whom it had been entrusted. The more he realized the absence of all personal motive in that old man, in whom there seemed to remain only the habit of passions, and in place of an intellect, grouping events and drawing conclusions, only the capacity calmly to contemplate the course of events, the more reassured he was that everything would be as it should. "He will not bring in any plan of his own. He will not devise or undertake anything," thought Prince Andrew. "But he will hear everything, remember everything, and put everything in its place. He will not hinder anything useful, nor allow anything harmful. He understands that there is something stronger and more important than his own will, the inevitable course of events.
and he can see them and grasp their significance, and seeing that significance, can refrain from meddling and renounce his personal wish directed to something else. And above all, thought Prince Andrew, one believes in him because he's Russian, despite the novel by Jean Lys and the French proverbs, and because his voice shook when he said, "What they have brought us to," and had a sob in it when he said he would make them eat horse flesh. On such feelings, more or less dimly shared by all, the unanimity and general approval were founded, with which, despite court influences, the popular choice of Kutuzov as commander-in-chief was received. Chapter 17. Moscow after the Emperor's visit. Rostopchin's broadsheets. Julie's farewell soiree. Forfeits for speaking French. Pierre hears of Princess Mary's arrival in Moscow. After the Emperor had left Moscow, life flowed on there in its usual course, and its course was so very usual that it was difficult to remember the recent days of patriotic elation and order. Hard to believe that Russia was really in danger, and that the members of the English club were also sons of the fatherland, ready to sacrifice everything for it. The one thing that recalled the patriotic fervor everyone had displayed during the Emperor's stay was the call for contributions of men and money, a necessity that, as soon as the promises had been made, assumed a legal, official form and became unavoidable. With the enemy's approach to Moscow, the Muscovites' view of their situation did not grow more serious, but, on the contrary, became even more frivolous, as always happens with people who see a great danger approaching. At the approach of danger, there are always two voices that speak with equal power in the human soul. One very reasonably tells a man to consider the nature of the danger and the means of escaping it. The other, still more reasonably, says that it is too depressing and painful to think of the danger, since it is not in man's power to foresee everything and avert the general course of events, and it is therefore better to disregard what is painful till it comes, and to think about what is pleasant. In solitude, a man generally listens to the first voice, but in society to the second. So it was now with the inhabitants of Moscow. It was long since people had been as gay in Moscow as that year. Rostopchin's broadsheets, headed by woodcuts of a drink shop, a potman, and a Moscow burgher called Karpushka Chigirin, who, having been a militiaman and having had rather too much at the pub, heard that Napoleon wished to come to Moscow, grew angry, abused the French in very bad language, came out of the drink shop, and under the sign of the eagle began to address the assembled people, were read and discussed, together with the latest of Vasily Lvovich Pushkin's Bourimé. In the corner room at the club, members gathered to read these broadsheets, and some liked the way Karpushka jeered at the French, saying, "They will swell up with Russian cabbage, burst with our buckwheat porridge, and choke themselves with cabbage soup. They're all dwarfs, and one peasant woman will toss three of them with a hay fork." Others did not like that tone, and said it was stupid and vulgar. It was said that Rostopchin had expelled all Frenchmen, and even all foreigners, from Moscow, and that there had been some spies and agents of Napoleon among them. But this was told chiefly to introduce Rostopchin's witty remark on that occasion. The foreigners were deported to Nizhny by boat, and Rostopchin had said to them in French, "Rentrez en vous-même, entrez dans la barque, et n'en faites pas une barque de caron." Think it over, get into the bark, and take care not to make it a bark of Karen. There was talk of all the government offices having been already removed from Moscow, and to this Shinshin's witticism was added, that for that alone Moscow ought to be grateful to Napoleon. It was said that Mamonov's regiment would cost him 800,000 rubles, and that Bezukhov had spent even more on his, but that the best thing about Bezukhov's action was that he himself was going to don a uniform and ride at the head of his regiment without charging anything for the show. "You don't spare anyone," said Julie Drubetskaya, as she collected and pressed together a bunch of raveled lint with her thin, beringed fingers. Julie was preparing to leave Moscow next day and was giving a farewell soiree. "Bezukhov est ridicule. Bezukhov is absurd. But he is so kind and good-natured. What pleasure is there to be so caustique?" "A forfeit," cried a young man in militia uniform, whom Julie called Mon Chevalier, and who was going with her to Nizhny. In Julie's set, as in many other circles in Moscow, it had been agreed that they would speak nothing but Russian, and that those who made a slip and spoke French should pay fines to the Committee of Voluntary Contributions. "Another forfeit for a Gallicism," said a Russian writer who was present. "What pleasure is there to be is not Russian." "You spare no one," continued Julie to the young man without heeding the author's remark. "For caustique, I'm guilty and will pay, and I'm prepared to pay again for the pleasure of telling you the truth. For Gallicisms, I won't be responsible," she remarked, turning to the author. "I have neither the money nor the time, like Prince Galitzin, to engage a master to teach me Russian." "Ah, here he is," she added. "Quand on..." No, she said to the militia officer, "you won't catch me. Speak of the sun and you see its rays." And she smiled amiably at Pierre. "We were just talking of you," she said, with the facility in lying natural to a society woman. "We were saying that your regiment would be sure to be better than Mamonov's." "Oh, don't talk to me of my regiment," replied Pierre, kissing his hostess's hand and taking a seat beside her. "I'm so sick of it." "You will, of course, command it yourself," said Julie, directing a sly, sarcastic glance toward the militia officer. The latter, in Pierre's presence, had ceased to be caustic, and his face expressed perplexity as to what Julie's smile might mean. In spite of his absent-mindedness and good nature, Pierre's personality immediately checked any attempt to ridicule him to his face. "No," said Pierre, with a laughing glance at his big, stout body. "I should make too good a target for the French. Besides, I'm afraid I should hardly be able to climb onto a horse." Among those whom Julie's guests happened to choose to gossip about were the Rostovs. "I hear that their affairs are in a very bad way," said Julie. "And he is so unreasonable. The Count himself, I mean. The Razumovskys wanted to buy his house and his estate near Moscow, but it drags on and on. He asks too much."
"No, I think the sale will come off in a few days," said someone. "Though it is madness to buy anything in Moscow now."
"Why?" asked Julie. "You don't think Moscow is in danger?"
"Then why are you leaving?"
"I? What a question. I'm going because... well, because everyone is going. And besides, I'm not Joan of Arc or an Amazon."
"Well, of course, of course. Let me have some more strips of linen."
"If he manages the business properly, he will be able to pay off all his debts," said the militia officer, speaking of Rostov. "A kindly old man, but not up to much. And why do they stay on so long in Moscow? They meant to leave for the country long ago. Natalie is quite well again now, isn't she?" Julie asked Pierre with a knowing smile.
"They're waiting for their younger son," Pierre replied. "He joined Obolensky's Cossacks and went to Bielaya Tserkov, where the regiment is being formed, but now they've had him transferred to my regiment and are expecting him every day. The Count wanted to leave long ago, but the Countess won't on any account leave Moscow till her son returns."
"I met them the day before yesterday at the Arkharovs. Natalie has recovered her looks and is brighter. She sang a song. How easily some people get over everything."
"Get over what?" inquired Pierre, looking displeased. Julie smiled.
"You know, Count, such knights as you are only found in Madame de Souza's novels."
"What knights? What do you mean?" demanded Pierre, blushing.
"Oh, come, my dear Count. C'est la fable de tout Moscou. Je vous admire, ma parole d'honneur.
It is the talk of all Moscow. My word, I admire you."
"Forfeit, forfeit," cried the militia officer.
"All right, one can't talk. How tiresome." "What is the talk of all Moscow?" Pierre asked angrily, rising to his feet.
"Come now, Count, you know."
"I don't know anything about it," said Pierre.
"I know you were friendly with Natalie, and so..." But I was always more friendly with Viera. Dear Viera. No, madame, Pierre continued in a tone of displeasure. I've not taken on myself the role of Natalie Rostova's knight at all, and have not been to their house for nearly a month. But I cannot understand the cruelty. Qui s'excuse, s'accuse. Who excuses himself, accuses himself, said Julie, smiling and waving the lint triumphantly. And to have the last word, she promptly changed the subject. Do you know what I heard today? Poor Mary Bolkonskaya arrived in Moscow yesterday. Do you know that she's lost her father? Really? Where is she? I should like very much to see her, said Pierre. I spent the evening with her yesterday. She's going to their estate near Moscow either today or tomorrow morning with her nephew. Well, and how is she? Asked Pierre. She's well, but sad. But do you know who rescued her? It is quite a romance. Nicholas Rostov. She was surrounded, and they wanted to kill her, and had wounded some of her people. He rushed in and saved her. Another romance, said the militia officer. Really, this general flight has been arranged to get all the old maids married off. Katish is one, and Princess Bolkonskaya another. Do you know, I really believe she is un petit peu amoureuse du jeune homme. A little bit in love with the young man. Forfeit, forfeit, forfeit. But how could one say that in Russian? Chapter 18. Rostopchin's Broadsheets. Pierre and the Eldest Princess. Leppich's Balloon. A Public Flogging. Pierre Leaves Moscow for the Army. When Pierre returned home, he was handed two of Rostopchin's broadsheets that had been brought that day. The first declared that the report that Count Rostopchin had forbidden people to leave Moscow was false. On the contrary, he was glad that ladies and tradesmen's wives were leaving the city. There will be less panic and less gossip, ran the broadsheet. But I will stake my life on it that that scoundrel will not enter Moscow. These words showed Pierre clearly for the first time that the French would enter Moscow.